everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the Substation podcast. In this episode, as this is primarily a market design podcast, we're going to talk about one of the most exciting developments, I would say, in market design history for the last few years.
Sure, I can be excited. I have the capacity to be excited. So alongside the government's energy security strategy that came out in April 2022, the government announced that they would be doing something that they haven't done for a long time called the Review of Energy Market Arrangements, which is kind of like Electricity Market Reform 2.0. Mm-hmm.
Only hopefully bigger and better.
Yeah. And as I'm fond of saying, Electricity Market Reform did everything except reform the electricity market.
Yeah.
So perhaps this one will be different. So, I mean, I guess the context is there's these security strategy, which is all about, you know, talking about weaning ourselves off gas, hitting our targets, 50 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030, which is a massively huge increase in ambition from the original target of 30 gigawatts, then 40, and now it's 50, talking about having 8 new nuclear power stations, one built every year, hydrogen, long-duration energy storage, all of this sort of kind of huge infrastructure announcements, the future system operator as well, hiving out the part of National Grid that does system operation and planning, putting that into a separate publicly owned company. There's a little sentence in there that says, and we'll also kick off the review of energy market arrangements. Emma, what is it that they're going to be doing?
Well, I suppose exactly what isn't going to be in scope remains to be seen, but at the moment it looks like the scope is fairly ambitious. So they're going to be focusing on electricity and the ability for the electricity market and the market arrangements that sit around it to support the transition to net zero. It's not just the energy market. It's all of the other bits that interact with it. So things like capacity markets, ancillary services, et cetera. Thinking about what kind of market arrangements we need to support this ambitious transition we have just to net zero. I don't think gas is in scope, is it?
Kind of. It can be. It depends on how it interacts with the energy market. Mm. But the intention is how can we get to the kind of 2035 world where the government thinks there'll be no fossil fuels emitted in order to provide electricity. That's a point in which, or at least no carbon, so there might be carbon cash usage and storage. We might be using fossil fuels, we're just not unabatedly emitting that carbon into the atmosphere. So in 2035, how do you drive the necessary investment that's required to create that system, and how do you efficiently operate a system like that and make sure that it is good value for customers and secure and stable?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of chat recently and in the last few years about, you know, I suppose questions about whether our existing market and arrangements are suitable to support that transition. And I suppose there's probably general consensus that they aren't. You know, they've served us well. We've had, the electricity market since 2001. Then there's been various bolt-ons in form of capacity market and, you know, renewable subsidies, et cetera, since then. And I think this is a good opportunity to take a look at things holistically take a look at things holistically and see whether they work for this transition.
Yeah. And so there's been very little put out about this, but there was a phone call that was held that many energy market participants went to, and they set out kind of the objectives. So the kind of first thing would be to set out a clear rationale for future power system needs, agree what reform might be needed to help achieve those needs, and then C was kind of ensure reforms are implemented effectively. So what might be done to make sure that the market can achieve those goals, you know, make it that way. I think this builds on quite a lot that's been going on from other market participants. So like one of my interesting things is, you know, how do you think this will fit on top of all the other work everyone else has been doing? Mm-hmm. And is this the final word for the next five years?
It sounds kind of like it. So, you know, BEIS will obviously be working with, and government will be working with other participants in the market. So they'll be working with Ofgem and National Grid and, of course, industry. But I suppose the way it was described certainly sounds like it will be government who have, the, as you say, the final say on decisions across this spectrum of areas.
Yeah, which is only right. Obviously, government is the legislative body, so they're the ones who should have the final say. They make the laws, so they'd be needed anyway. I guess it'll be interesting to see how this feeds through from the ESOs, future net zero market design work that they've done that's due to finish nowish. Mm-hmm. I think they're supposed to publish their final report on what the ESO thinks the net zero market design looks mm-hmm. like. Ofgem has stepped up a team to look at future market design. They've got work going on locational marginal pricing. We've had the Energy Systems Catapult publishing their EMR 2.0 report. Yes. There was Laura Sanders' report on the future digital energy market. We've had the Aldersgate Group and UCL talking about green power pools. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much going on in electricity market design. It kind of feels like this is going to be the hot topic. But they've kind of done this before, haven't they? There was another review of market arrangements. How did that one go?
Well, I suppose which one? There's been a few. But I guess the most recent that I think you're alluding to is electricity market reform. So that ran, well, I might get my years wrong here, but I suppose what kicked it off was, I think, 2008, 2009, review called Project Discovery, in which I remember the chairman of Ofgem famously describing the Scooby-Doo problem. Have we ever talked about that? This idea that the energy market is facing this Scooby-Doo problem, whereby if you remember Scooby-Doo, used to eat really big sandwiches, like really, really mm-hmm. tall. And the key question was, you know, the sandwich facing the electricity market and, well, the system more generally was so big, we weren't sure whether Scooby-Doo was going to be able to eat the sandwich. There hasn't been any references to Scooby-Doo this time. Anyway, sorry. So Project Discovery 2008-2009 was the Ofgem kind of review of, okay, what do we think is needed in the next 10 years to meet our various objectives? You know, it set out the trilemma, so this idea of, you know, these three competing objectives of decarbonisation, security of supply, and then also affordability. Off the back of that, then, was a government white paper, which was looking at different options and different new interventions that might be needed to address these problems. Now, I suppose what I would say, well, like what you said earlier, it didn't really look at the energy market itself. So electricity market reform, as it turned out, and as the responsibilities were laid out, it was focusing more on security of supply mechanisms and renewable subsidies. It didn't, in fact, it didn't really touch the energy market or the electricity market itself. That was the remit of Ofgem, the regulator. So you had government doing one thing, the regulator doing another, and of course working together. But in practice, you know, the interventions and the ideas are being developed by different organizations, and maybe they could have been better integrated.
So in this case, BEIS is leading, yes. And they're going to be getting support from Ofgem and the ESO, yes. But ultimately decision-making power remains with BEIS, so that could be different.
I think that's a real positive. I think having all of the decisions for all the different areas in-house within one organization, so those decisions can be made together and optimized, will hopefully be a big improvement on the electricity market reform. And so, yeah, which kind of ran, what, 2010 to 2014-ish? Yeah.
And it also sounds like the scope of this is much wider. So it's not just, you know, how do we fix renewables investment and capacity adequacy this time? It's okay, we want to look at wholesale markets, capacity adequacy, low carbon investment, flexibility, system operation, location. And they've also talked about the linked areas that while they are, it's important. They've stressed that things like the retail market, demand side response, carbon emissions, interconnectors, and kind of carbon capture storage, hydrogen, aren't necessarily like directly in scope. They are linked, so that they're going to have to be considered in this. So I think that's also a good sign.
And I think another a good thing, as you mentioned, we have this sort of bigger role that we've already seen from National Grid, and future moving to this future system operator that will be probably getting even bigger with, you know, them performing this advisory role to government, which it probably wasn't doing as much back in during the EMR days. It was certainly inputting, it was certainly involved, but National Grid wasn't expected really to be driving those policy decisions and maybe challenging government and Ofgem in the way maybe in future it will. So I think that'll be a real positive I hope that will be a real positive for this next review and likely reform.
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing that struck me when they talked about it was how they said that they're not starting from a blank slate. They're not going to try and design the perfect market and fit it onto our market. They're going to start from where we are, not from where we'd like to be, which kind of is a positive in one sense, in that it maybe they'll be a bit more realistic about what's deliverable. I mean, we're never going to find, there's no such thing as a perfect market or a perfect design, or anyway, a practically implementable perfect design. So I thought that was a nice and pragmatic point of view. And it's interesting to think of them, then, you know, when you lay out all of those objectives, you know, of having investment, flexibility, the right networks in the right, with the right stuff in the right place, having an operable system, you know, all of those. And they're saying, you know, let's start from where we are. You can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think that's a good sign. It means that, that everything's going to be considered holistically. And, you've got to remember that government has more than one objective. You know, while when the ESO says we think the best market design is this, that, you know, that's just one point of view. From the point of view of a system operator who may have different objectives to developers, users of the network, and so forth. So I think I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I am too. Because I think, them taking that sort of more practical or pragmatic view, well, I suppose on the one hand, it's necessary as well, because there is already so much stuff going on. You know, there's reforms already being launched and ongoing in terms of capacity market, network charging, various elements of the wholesale market. So it's positive that they're seeking to build on that. Because I think a big risk or a big concern that you might have with a project like this is just the sheer complexity of it. And then, you know, what that therefore means for decisions and then implementation. Is there a risk that we have a delay in investment or that leads to investor uncertainty?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, in that if we're going to have 50 gigawatts of offshore wind, we can't be quibbling about whether or not we have a CFD in 10 years' time, because everyone's going to down tools if we say that we're thinking about changing the CFD to a very significant extent. And if you've got targets for 2030, it's just not going to be practical. Something else they said that's obviously very dear to our hearts is they said that locational marginal prices are within scope, so they'll definitely be looking at that.
And I think it sounds more like it's an element of the overall project, whereas I suppose if we compare that to National Grid's work on net zero markets, the locational marginal price question was very much front and center. You know, this is almost the first decision that we need to make, and other things will flow from that. Whereas I get the sense with the Bayes reform project that they haven't made up their mind on which direction to go on anything. And the question about locational marginal pricing is just one question among many.
Yeah. So that's where they're kind of saying, we think that you can get some good locational signals by pricing power where it's produced or consumed, you drive good investment decisions, but they're also recognizing that you also make the market a lot more complicated, and that they want to understand the practical aspects of doing that. So how does one trade? How do you hedge out the risk of buying power in one location, selling it in the other, whether or not the network is constrained between those two points, which you do with a financial transmission right? How do you, as a electricity consumer, find a financial transmission right? How do you hedge that price? As a trader, what kind of collateral do you have to hold? How many relationships do I have to have? How does one settle this kind of market? All those kind of things, I think, are going to be on the thing. And I think if you look at it in that way, they will probably come to the conclusion that it's, or in my opinion, they'll find that it's very complicated, but there are ways of managing that complexity and putting the risk on the parties who are best able to manage it and mitigating it for those who aren't.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the thing with location and marginal pricing, isn't it? Economists love it, and engineers probably love it to a degree, but once you start to think about the human element and, you know, the domestic customer and that angle, it's less clear cut, but maybe there's a happy middle ground.
I think the other thing that they mentioned was that they were looking for schemes that, or a design that supports a nth of a kind developments, not first of a kind developments.
I'd never heard that before. What does it mean?
So if you see the acronym NOAK, that stands for nth of a kind. So it means, you know, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, the whatever number, a part of a serial production. Uh-huh. So for, we would consider, say, a wind farm, solar panels, offshore wind farms, would be nth of a kind because we know how to build them, factories produce them. It's not the first one we've done.
So it's kind of business as usual.
Yeah. And if you see the acronym FOAK, that stands for first of a kind, which is, this is the first one we've done. So for example, Hinkley Point C is a good example of the FOAK because it's the first European pressurised reactor built in the UK. Hopefully Sizewell C will be the nth of a K European pressurised reactor, but it's quite unlikely. It might be that if we build a third one, that might be the nth of a kind one.
So what are they saying by saying they're going to focus on the nth of a kind projects rather than the first of a kind projects?
So first of a kind projects come with many more risks associated with them because it's the first time you might have deployed these or deployed them in this fashion. The business models are uncertain. The capital backing is uncertain. You don't know how they're operating in the market with very much accuracy. So they need a lot more support. So this might be like long duration storage of new types of technologies. These are risky assets kind of just coming to commercial viability. And so they need some extra support because they've got a higher cost of capital, greater risk in the market. So typically you'd support them with either longer, you know, firm revenues over a long time, or maybe just cap and floor arrangements, you know, something regulated asset based kind of arrangements, something that removes a lot of that uncertainty and risk. Nth of a kind, basically everyone should be able to build these because the manufacturers are there, that lessons have been learned, the commercial business case is simple and easy to understand, so they don't need that same level of support. They shouldn't actually require very much government intervention to get built. So if you're designing a market to support nth of a kind technologies, what you mean is we've actually learned all the lessons that we need to learn about building solar farms, wind farms. We should just be focusing on what are the issues that we know we can deal with and how can we help the market and individual developers manage those issues rather than taking all the risk on the public books because it's, you know, it's the first of a kind.
Interesting. So I guess thinking about, well, looking at subsidy mechanisms historically, they've maybe been more geared towards supporting the investors and making sure there's revenue certainty. But I suppose the cost of that is that the consumer or the public effectively manage or bear that cost. So I suppose, would we expect a market that's more focused on nth of a kind to be a bit more, I suppose, expose investors to potential costs a bit more, that kind of thing?
Yes. And I think the incentive would be that there's less kind of bespoke arrangements for everybody and that the kind of arrangements that there are capable of dealing with multiple types of technologies. and we're not seeing huge like leaps in changes in the technology type over time. We're not suddenly switching from like, you know, large baseload thermal power stations to variable renewables. We're probably likely to, you know, keep using large amounts of variable renewables. And that, yeah.
Do you think we're ready to do that? Because it does feel like there's a lot of, well, there's still a lot of innovation happening in energy. There's still a lot of unanswered questions about whether certain technologies will come forward. Will they become viable?
I think for some things, the answer's clear. Like, we know that wind and solar are pretty much probably going to be in the form that they are now. They'll just get more efficient. When it's unlikely we're going to see a significant change in wind turbine design in the next 30 years. Solar panels, maybe, but then it's just the technology that's changing, not the way you develop them or deploy them. It's still just a panel attached to an inverter. You know, I don't think we'll see huge changes in what we would call like the bulk energy supplies. I think there's still a bit of way to go in our grid management technologies and flexibility technologies. I think we can probably agree that things like long duration energy storage, genuinely new types of nuclear power, hydrogen, those don't necessarily fit into that bracket. But I think we know that the bulk of our electricity we'll get from the sun and the wind.
Carbon capture as well, right? That would fit into the latter bracket.
That will fit into the first of a kind, yeah.
First of a kind, yeah.
Yeah, because I think there's never been a commercially operational first carbon capture usage and storage power plant that wasn't driven by enhanced oil recovery. Mm-hmm. So there are plants that capture the carbon, but they just use it to pump more oil out the ground.
Mm-hmm.
This is all likely to be issued for a consultation this summer. And you've then got until the autumn to write your what is likely to be quite a large response, which is when the consultation will close.
But it'll be interesting because they're not going to have proposals at this stage, right? I suppose this is going to be more maybe the problem statement or part of the problem statement, potential options for reform, or even just potential ways to reform. We might not even be at the point of having options on the table yet.
Yeah, I think you're quite right there. It's likely to be, we think this is the problem and these are the ways we might deal with it. And then they'll get feedback and then it will be an iterative process of engagement, you know, with it, workshops, more consultations, kind of challenges issued to industry, bilateral meetings that BEIS has that helps them narrow that down. And there'll probably be 2-3 more consultations that kind of nail this down before we get to a final design or a final decision. And even then we might be in we'll be in a different parliamentary term.
Oh gosh, yeah, different government. And there might not even be one decision, right? Like, it could be there's an overarching decision and then there's all these sub decisions to be made. You know, the scope is huge, so if you are talking about wholesale and ancillary services and capacity market, you know, it would be hard to do all of that in one fell swoop.
Yes. So realistically, this process is probably just a 1 to 2 year process with another couple of years after that for detailed design. So don't necessarily hold your breath, but
I'm I don't know what the opposite of holding my breath is. I'm geared up to get involved. I'm excited. What lessons do you think we can learn from electricity market reform? Because you were involved to some degree. Were you? Or were you? You're not.
Only as someone who was reporting on it.
Ah, fine. Well, you were. Yeah, you saw it happen. You saw it.
Yeah, I saw it. I saw it unfold. I guess my overarching view of electricity market reform would be that looking back on it with hindsight, seems to have been relatively successful. Like, I guess we quibble about the details and we can improve it. But if you look, you know, the capacity market is there. It pays people. Whether or not, it's difficult to say if there would be a counterfactual, but I think it's probably safe to say that given the government fought tooth and nail to have it brought back, that it's somewhat necessary, and that the CFD was successful in lowering the cost of capital. So I think when you set out with a clear design and an objective, EMR shows that you can do that. It comes with some costs. And whether or not government was clear in that they were accepting those costs, because the CFD insulates you to a huge extent from the wholesale market. It also drives, cutting capital costs, cutting operational costs to the bone, and putting a lot of faith on subsidies or revenues outside of the subsidy window to get in at that first gate. So it was very successful in one sense, but you've driven a bunch of behaviours and stuff in everywhere else. And, you know, they focused down on one thing, which was lower the cost of capital. Great, we got some results out of that. We had some problems around it, you know, that we've driven behaviours in other areas, and of course the wider kind of available budgets and auctions weren't there when they should have been, and it could have been widened out to other technologies. So it's not like there weren't problems, but I feel that, you know, that objective that they set themselves, they achieved.
Yeah. I think from my perspective, so I was involved. I was working at Ofgem at the time in wholesale markets. So I was working on reform to cash out prices, so imbalance prices. So we were working quite closely with the capacity market team in government, because obviously you want those two things to work together in perfect harmony. But I suppose, yeah, to the point that I made earlier, you know, there was different organizations doing different things, and, you know, you can collaborate with colleagues across the other side of Westminster or whatever, but ultimately decisions were happening and being made in different places, and detailed design was being made in different places. And I think that led to, you know, interactions, maybe unforeseen consequences from the CFD and the capacity market on the wholesale market and network charging and, you know, the whole range of different areas that, you know, we didn't necessarily pick those things up. I'm really hopeful that the scope is now broader and the remit for the decisions is sitting quite clearly with government, rather than being split up. So I think that's a real win in terms of the, well, lessons learned from EMR.
Yeah. But then I think you might have to brace yourself for disappointment, because there's going to have to be, you know, there is no perfect answer, and they will take an opinion on what they think is the best for the objectives that they've got. And if that means sacrificing efficiency in one area to get it in another, they will. So it might, you know, they might be willing to say, we want a really efficient market that'll drive the outcomes that we want the most. So we're going to target that with utmost efficiency. That could lead to unintended consequences elsewhere. So it could lead to, you know, making it harder to trade. You reduce the number of parties in the market, increase barriers to entry.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think we've got there's going to be unintended consequences.
Sure.
It's going to be very difficult to manage anything holistically like this. And it's going to involve trade-offs.
Oh, totally. But at least there's one organization who is making decisions on those trade-offs. Whereas I think when things are just happening in different organizations and in different buildings, those trade-offs aren't necessarily being picked up.
And they can be counterproductive as well. Yeah. Like you might make a change, or often might recommend a change to achieve one objective, but that goes counter to the objective that Bayes have got, and you end up with perverse incentives.
Yeah.
The capacity market.
I was just about to say, I mean, the capacity market was going to build us, I don't know how many new combined cycle gas turbines. I don't know how many we wanted to be built and how many were actually built.
Technically one. I can't think of any CCGT that actually waited to get its capacity market before it built.
Yeah.
Because Keeby went before, as did Carrington.
And what actually happened was we saw, instead of large transmission scale generators being built, we saw a lot of smaller distributed assets that were embedded within the network that were through, I don't know how to explain this shortly, that were, because they were embedded, they were receiving other revenue streams that we call embedded benefits, that the larger assets weren't, and that was due to a quirk in how we do network charging, which is now being reformed. But you know, we didn't see that interaction, or it doesn't appear that policymakers saw that interaction when the capacity mechanism was being designed. So what do you think it's going to be called then, its new market? Because we've got REMA. It's probably REMA, isn't it? So which is the review of the electricity market arrangements.
Electricity market making arrangements.
Yay!
Because I've already got the network one, so that's fine. Oh no, I've got the half hourly settlement one. That's me, isn't it? Target operational model.
Oh, very nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your middle name? Oh, it's just Tom. I'm sorry. Yeah, good.
I said, don't worry, my full initials spell the, so I'm covered for basically everything.
Oh, I would love an industry acronym to be named after me. Obviously after me and in my honour, rather than just through a happy accident. I'm kind of expecting it just to be called REMA, because that just seems to be how acronyms work in energy. Like, you kind of come up with something and then it sticks, even if it's no longer appropriate. So like NETA, we still call our wholesale market in Britain, is often still called NETA, which is the new energy trading arrangements. They're 21 years old now. and also we have Scotland now.
There's no harm in getting your preferred candidate out there, ahead of the others. I think REMA's snappy at the very least. It's easy to say. So credit to them for pulling one out of the bag in the acronym game.
Yeah, it's not like one of those long, unwieldy acronyms that really shouldn't be pronounced, but yet people still try.
Like ICRP.
Yeah.
That one's always fun to say out loud. Oh, the other one, the residual cash flow, reallocation cash flow, that one's fun to say out loud.
Well, it depends on which accent you have.
Yes, mine.
Well, you say
you're gonna make me say RC, aren't you?
Yeah, that's better than RC, which is what I say.
Yeah, but mine sounds like bottom. Anyway, welcome to this month's acronym corner. So I think that probably covers everything we want to say about REMA at this stage. It's exciting if you're into electricity market design. This is probably going to be the biggest source of uncertainty and change in the fundamental arrangements for the electricity market in the last 20 years.
Yeah, easily. 25, I'd say.
Oof, yeah. Bold.
uncertainty, change, you could also say excitement and challenge.
Yeah. But thank you for listening. I've been Tom Edwards.
And I've been Emma Burns.
And this has been the Substation Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Substation Podcast, or you can follow Tom at Notional Grid or Emma at Energy Burns. We also have a LinkedIn page where you can contact us. We have an email address that's also on our LinkedIn page.